You found the Digging Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening to our show. If you have been enjoying our little show, please consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. All right, before we get our little podcast started here, let me get in another plug for our Patreon page. If you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you, that's it, $5 a month, and you'd like to see the podcast keep going strong, please consider becoming a patron of our show. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland and sign up. Patrons get exclusive access to a live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. And that chat really is the best part of doing all this. So come and join us. Again, folks, patreon.com/diggingoakisland. Sign up. Support the podcast. $5 a month. You can cancel anytime. Also, if you prefer to not do the monthly thing, but you want to donate, makes all the sense in the world. I get that. You can make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use my username at Dave McBride Music. I'm a musician. That's sort of my virtual chip jar. And I need to take a minute here and send a huge thank you out to both Mike and Mike. That's right. Two Mikes. Two listeners, both named Mike, donated to the podcast this week. Gentlemen, thank you guys so very, very much. I can't tell you how much it means to have your support. That was incredibly generous of the both of you. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Anyway, as always, let's start today's podcast with emails and messages from you, the listeners. And let's start today with one of those Mikes, those two who donated. He actually goes by the name Red. So Red writes, and my grandfather's name was Red, so I understand, but his given name was James, not Mike, but close enough. My other grandfather was named Mike. I'm just realizing this right now. Anyway, Red, I don't think you're either one of my grandfathers, since neither of them are still here. He writes, "Hey, Dave, my name is Red, longtime listener, first-time writer. I've been a huge fan of the show since day one and the podcast for about 2 years. Thank you for all your hard work. First, last year, there were a lot of emails about your perceived negativity in your podcast. I cannot disagree more with that sentiment. I frankly love your perspective and never doubt your enthusiasm for the show or your well-directed frustration with the editing. You walk an excellent line between appreciating the mystery and history behind the show and being distrustful of the clear entertainment bias of the editors that comes at the expense of the truth. People who are frustrated with the show in general should remember it started towards the tail end of the History Channel riding the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code wave of popular culture Templar obsession in the late aughts. Do the editors and producers overdo it and stretch facts to fit the Templar narrative? Sure. But a close examination of the people in the show proves that most of them are level-headed about the Templar connection. Marty is the most so. He's deliberate, sticks to the evidence, and like Laird and the other archaeologists, he seems to be driven by the scientific method. Rick is more romantic, but cautiously opines about all the possibilities. While I agree with your Xena map can't be real analysis, I admire Rick's devotion to her. The rest of the players seem to lean towards a decidedly less scientific and imaginative interpretation of the evidence. Jack, Alex, and of course, Gary, the Bobby Dazzler himself. They seem to feed the producer's machine, but they're still fun." Let me just interrupt here real quick. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, and I love the way you put that. Like, Jack is there to be more imaginative and more enthusiastic. So is Gary. Alex, I think, is a little bit more measured and suspicious than is made out on the show. There's actually a little hint in this week's episode where he says, I'm starting to have my skepticism towards the Templar theory break down here. You see what I mean by that. Anyway, Red continues. "The interplay between these main guys is what makes the Gilligan's Island analogy that another listener made so perfect. But it also makes this season really good, and maybe the best in my opinion. Others have pointed this out, but when Marty and Laird get excited about something, it means so much more. And they've been excited, smiling even, a lot this season. Some quick thoughts." And he goes through a few different things here, so we'll just name them off, and I'll interrupt when I need to. Remember when they worried about money all the time? Limited amount of caissons in the ground per season, and when they started to run out, they'd have a whole war room segment on budgetary concerns. Things sure have changed. Okay, and I'm going to chime in actually right here, because this does get brought up quite a bit, this issue with the money and all that kind of stuff. It was par for the course, certainly for the first few seasons, because when the show began, the History Channel was not, should we say, invested in the dig. What weren't partnering with the dig. They were really just shooting what was going on. But that changed somewhere along the line. And I think really Gary and his lead cross is what really changed it. It's because since then, the History Channel, as I understand it, have kind of worked hand in hand with the Laginas to help fund the dig. Now, Marty is very, very guarded when it comes to talking about this in public. He's done many an interview, doesn't really answer this. He doesn't seem to like discussing the finances, but he has, however, admitted openly and sort of, you know, pretty definitively that the network helps. But he will not, and no one else will say to what degree. And honestly, when it gets right down to it, Red, I don't really care. I'm just happy that the result is what we have here now is the best funded Oak Island search in history. Anyway, Red continues. He writes, I'm so glad the water engineer dude has written into you recently. He recently said the fellowship measures the depth of the drilling from the surface, which makes sense, but they often compare their drilling depths and finds underground to the depths cited in the searcher's historical records. With all the destruction of the money pit area over the years, how does the fellowship know the surface level they are measuring from is the same as that from which the searchers measured, the previous searchers? Maybe Patrick can help on this one. Patrick, if you're listening. Recently in your podcast with the trailer for Corian Maul and Chris Morford's full interview episode, Corian said something interesting. At about the 44-minute mark of your Season 11, Episode 9, Filling Cavities podcast, right after talking about the historic find in Europe, which we have yet to see, by the way, Corian says, quote, there would be a lot of hardship this season, but there will be a happy ending. This blew my mind. There hasn't been anything like a happy ending to any season. And he just blurts this out. And you don't follow up. My dude, I've been obsessing over this since the podcast dropped. I really hope we get some answers this season. Maybe that's why there aren't as many episodes. All right, man. Thank you for taking the time and for all of your efforts. I'm a Giants fan, but if I weren't, I'd like the Pirates. Yeah, go Buccos. Great team you got there. Overperformed early last season, but should come out strong and last for the duration of this year. We can only hope, Red. We can only hope. I feel like it's starting to move forward. He writes, good luck. May the Bobby Dazzlers ever be in your top pocket, Red. Okay. First of all, Red, about the remark with the Corian Maul interview. I know, Red. I know. Right. I will tell you, I did not follow up on air on the podcast, because as soon as he said that, I was 100% certain he would not be able to elaborate really at all because of the non-disclosure agreements they all have to sign. He just left it out there, and I thought it best to kind of pull a Prometheus here and leave it hanging there as a tantalizing little nugget for all of our listeners, like the non-ferrous metal in the garden shaft at the end of last year, or, you know, pick your cliffhanger that never got resolved. I got to tell you guys, I'm honestly stunned it took this long for one of you guys to call me out on that. Anyway, great stuff, Red. Keep those emails coming. Great to hear from you. Let's go now to another Mike. This Mike writes, after listening to all your pods, I have to say that we share the same gripes, but we love the show and look forward to it every week. We love the adventure, the history, and the discovery. Here's the question from Charlie and I. If you had your way, what part of the island would you focus on, and what would you do with it? Okay, great question. I love that. I think in my mind, as somebody who is taking this from an investigative point of view, right, the key is to try and vet things out until you can cross them off the list. That's what I want to accomplish. So with that in mind, I think where I would go sort of, you know, all in, chips all in, would be in the swamp. Because to me, what is that road? Who built it? Is there really not a record of it of its existence from before the current road was built, right? The road that that's there now that the guys always drive across was built in the early 1900s. We've said this a million times. It forever changed the face of the swamp, probably caused a lot of fill in there, a lot of water that moved around the dirt, and maybe even caused things to be covered up. So was there really nothing there before that? Was this been covered completely that long? I kind of want to know that kind of stuff because, and again, I'm talking about the swamp. I'm not talking about the ship in the swamp theory. They disproved that years ago. I'm talking about, most importantly, this stone path. I think that's what I would try to at least get an answer on. Of all the things they've found, this is the first truly undocumented feature that is completely mysterious. I would start there. Is it really centuries old? Really? What was it used for? Can we cross it off the list as something maybe a farmer created or just used to get crops off the island? I would want answers to things like that first and foremost. Now, this answer can certainly change by the end of the year, right? When we see what is underneath the garden shaft. But this week, we kind of got a little bit of a disappointment in that. So as of right now, at this moment, I'd say the swamp is the thing that most interests me, most specifically the stone road, followed closely by this foundation at Lot 5. But again, this week kind of put a little damper on that, just a little one. In my mind, these are the things that have the ability to answer a lot of questions about the early history of Oak Island. It's a great question, Mike. Thank you very much. Now, here is Jim, who has some follow-up information on a question we discussed last week about the lack of any reported shorings or fortifications found in the original Money Pit story. Jim writes, "Hi, Dave. I enjoy listening to the Digging Oak Island podcast. Always informative, very well produced. The information presented is relevant and meaningful. I appreciate the logic and reason that you and your listeners apply to the show and the many theories and conjectures presented by the producers. The theories are always interesting, but the light of common sense that you and your listeners provide often illuminates their shortcomings. On season 11, episode 17, the podcast, Gary in England asked about shoring, or the lack thereof, to prevent the collapse of the early pits dug on Oak Island. There is an article that appeared in the Liverpool Transcript edition of August 20th, 1857, that seems to describe the shoring of some of the early pits. The article can be accessed here, and he has the link, which I can put in for you guys. Most people have read this article, obviously. This is one of the main things that we've, that all of us have based the early history of the Money Pit on. Right. Anyway, he continues, "A regular correspondent to the Transcript, Mr. J.P. Forks, writes of receiving an invitation from a Mr. James Bond, yes, sir, to visit Oak Island. Mr. Forks writes that once at the island, he observed three open pits filled with water and a fourth pit, presumably the Money Pit, that had been refilled. He describes the pits as oblong squares measuring approximately 12 feet by 8 feet. He further describes them as being boxed in, as Mr. Forks may call it, with timber some 8 inches square in a workmanlike and substantial manner. This sounds like shoring of the pit walls to prevent collapse. I haven't found any references, however, to shoring of the original Money Pit itself, but have read the accounts of pick marks visible in the dirt along the sides of the pit, which makes it seem as though they weren't. Personally, I would not have wanted my feet to be at the bottom of any hole more than about 5 feet deep that wasn't protected from a collapse. Hopefully, the letter from the Transcript provides useful information or at least provides an avenue for further investigation. Thank you again for your excellent podcast, Jim." Thank you, Jim. Yeah, Gary's comments on this can be summed up in one line from his email that that read, quote, "Are we really to believe that someone, be the Templars, the British, the Spanish, the Portuguese, dropped a 100-foot-plus shaft without shoring? I've thought about this idea since, and I guess the only way this really works out is if whoever made the original shaft removed the shoring on their way out, leaving only platforms in place. From the standpoint of an original shaft and its purpose, the platforms don't really make a lot of sense. I never understood what they were actually used for, but I suppose, if I'm just kind of spitballing ideas here, perhaps they were there to aid in the process of removing the shoring and making their way back up. Who knows?" And you are correct, my friend. There is absolutely zero chance that I would ever go down a 100-foot hole that isn't fortified somehow. I certainly wouldn't bring the Ark of the Covenant down there under those conditions either if I were a Knights Templar sworn to its protection. Seems very far-fetched to me, but we need to operate under the understanding that we do not have anywhere near all the information. Anyway, great stuff, Jim. Thank you. All right, let's go now to our old friend Jock, who writes, "Hi, Dave. Thank you for your great work keeping this podcast going. More interesting than the show. I happen to be in the States, Oregon right now, and I happen to watch tonight's show ahead of the Canadian schedule. I was surprised they said the Vikings had visited New Brunswick, not Newfoundland, where there is a definite proof of an excavation there in the north at L'Anse-aux-Meadows. I think it's called L'Anse-aux-Meadows. So I Googled that question of New Brunswick, and I came up with this, and I quote, did Vikings visit New Brunswick's Miramichi and Chaleur Bay areas? According to the research done by Brigida Wallace, senior archaeologist emerita with Parks Canada, they did. Quote, I am really convinced that the Vikings did visit the area. Not all my colleagues would agree with me, end quote, said the woman who's been studying Vikings for 50 years. While she is certain the Vikings did spend time in New Brunswick, she says she is not hopeful of ever finding anything to prove it. So again, this show likes to stretch the truth to fit their quote-unquote weekly special. This week, the Scandinavians. And of course, did they try to associate the Vikings with the Templars? Did I hear that correctly? I'm not sure it was well known that the Vikings and the Templars worked together. No wonder this show is losing credibility with me. Hang on, Jock. Hang on. Anyway, he concludes here with, also, did you hear the narrator call the alleged tunnel under the garden shaft, quote, the treasure tunnel? Marty and Rick, there are planks in the garden shaft. What makes you certain it is a tunnel and furthermore a treasure tunnel? Yikes. Cheers, Jock from British Columbia. Great info as always, Jock. And Jock sent in this article from the CBC about Miss Wallace and the work she's done on the subject. I'll post it again on the Facebook page for you guys to check it out. Jock, with regards to the tunnel, we're going to learn more about that. This episode probably kind of altered a little bit of what you're thinking on both of those subjects, at least one in, depending on how you look at it. But what I'll say is this, it's been a very popular thing over the years in that area of the world to theorize that the Vikings landed there, really all over the North Atlantic, right? New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, even Maine and beyond, right? And each one has varying degrees of evidence from over the years to help bolster their theory. But I do believe that you are correct, and I know you are, that only Newfoundland has actual archaeological proof, actual proof to back it up. And certainly nothing the guys have found so far on Oak Island indicates the Vikings were there. Nothing really. Of course, that can always change. But so far, nothing that shows that to me. And as far as a link between the Vikings and the Templars, that can and will be certainly explored in just a few minutes. But we need to do that exploring, and we need to prove that before offering up an answer to, you know, a theory for the Oak Island mystery. What evidence is there of a connection? So far, we have a little. And again, we'll get to that in just a second. Great stuff, my man. Thank you. Let's go now to Scott in Denver, who writes, if the team is going to date Nolan's Cross and the stone piles at 1200 to 1250 AD, based on one man's archaeoastronomy theories, it would seem like an archaeological investigation of what is under those stones to be of first importance. If there was a piece of wood or other datable material underneath the rocks that was later than the proposed dates, that would, of course, disprove the 1200 to 1250 AD theory. Finding an object near, not underneath, these various stones is not proof of their date, as in the case with the lead object found near one of the stone piles. Why they do not have an archaeologist do a proper exploration around and underneath those various stone features is suspect. As always, thank you for your excellent work on the podcast, Scott from Denver. Great stuff, Scott, as always. I think you're totally correct in your suspicion here with regards to both the stone cairns and to Nolan's Cross. That doesn't mean I don't believe we won't someday be convinced that these things are the real deal. I mean, it's always possible. But I say this stuff a lot. Things Fred Nolan, quote unquote, discovered tend to have an air of mystery and a suspicion around them. That was the way Fred did things. And just like the stones of Nolan's Cross, Fred found these stone cairns, as far as I know, and they never had an archaeological excavation done and only had limited photographs even taken of them, photographs which, for whatever reason, we haven't seen on the show. Now, our friend Gordon Fader actually has a photograph of one of these, and he sent it to me. I'm going to post it on our Facebook page, and I could tell you that these stone cairns from these photos certainly look more like somebody piling up rocks for the sake of moving them out of the way than anything else. In fact, I'll read you a little bit of what my conversation with Gordon about this. He writes, yes, I have a picture of one of the cairns. It is a tall pile of small boulders. Fred mapped them, and I have his map as well. I suspect they are just boulders removed for farming, and instead of making walls in this area, they just piled them up. A lot of what Fred did is unknown as to why he did those things. Each boulder of the so-called cross has a story to tell, and I am unraveling those stories now. My clear conclusion is that they have been moved, and some at a great distance, and there is evidence to indicate Fred did it recently. Therefore, the cross cannot be old, and all those who use it as a basis for theories need to think that origin over very carefully. It's really interesting to think of that kind of thing, and that would fit kind of part of the course with some of the background of Fred Nolan. He was a little mysterious about these things. Again, he did not. There are no pictures of these supposed pyramids, as they like to show us, tell us about last week. And much of what Fred did reminds me a lot of the way Prometheus likes to handle many of these finds that we see on the show. How many times have you seen an item on this show over the years without that looks mysterious and could be this and without ever doing any real follow-up or analysis? We just see them once and never again. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of those, right? Now, I believe, and it's just a theory, that oftentimes they're doing this to leave us the viewers, with a feeling of mystery and intrigue around an item they probably know isn't really very mysterious or intriguing. And I think for that very same reason, Fred Nolan did kind of that same thing. He found things, he theorized about them, may or may not have proved any of those theories, but what he wanted to do is sort of leave this air of mystery that he held the key to what could be really important here on the island. And we were never privy to any much of any follow-up, if any at all. Here's the thing. Fred was in a constant battle with the Blankenships to prove what he was doing was worthy of the attention of the world, right? So did he exaggerate his claims to accomplish that? Man, I don't know. I don't want to accuse the guy of something I don't know, but I can tell you that that very question has led many skeptics to question and even dismiss Nolan and his finds, including Mr. Fader. I know it sounds like I'm doing the same thing here, accusing him of sort of lying to us, I guess, but I'm really not. I just want answers before I can believe in a theory or a discovery, right? I hope I'm making sense. Scott, that's a very, very long-winded way of saying I totally agree with you. We need an independent archaeological excavation of Nolan's Cross and those stone cairns. We need an archaeologist. Not Billy Gerhardt, not Gary Drayton. We need an independent archaeologist to really look at that stuff and show us, or else what are we talking about here? How can we base anything on Nolan's Cross if there's even the slightest bit of suspicion of its authenticity? And why haven't we done this work already? They've had access to it for years. Thank you again, Scott. Always great to hear from you. Now, kind of along the same lines of this discussion, let's finish up with our main man, Steve, who sent this in. Dave, I thought the diggers would appreciate these memories. Things just seem to randomly disappear from the show, process, and narrative. And then he lists some things off. The wash plant. They used to use that thing religiously. Now, nowhere to be seen and not used. Michael John, a treasure hunter. Remember that guy? He apparently worked for Billy or Gary. I think it was Billy. Peter's brother, David Fernetti. The Ball and McGinnis Foundations. Guess Laird will never get his wish. The well that, quote, never freezes and is way too close to the ocean. That was only from last year. Possible ties between Oak Island and nearby islands like Apple and Frog Islands. The fact that in season 10, they planned to cofferdam the swamp in season 11, which didn't occur. That's absolutely right. Virtually anything offshore. I think we've seen Tony Sampson once in like three seasons. Let me stop here. There's a reason for that, though, Steve, because no matter what they find, they can't bring it up. They don't have a license to do that. That's a very difficult process. Anyway, he continues with another one. The Eye of the Swamp. It's not like they can't find it. The mysterious and ancient wooden dam near Tom Nolan's house. Well, maybe we're getting kind of near that here. But yes, you're talking about not what we saw in today's episode, but in a few episodes back that we were going to follow up on. Crickets. Their regular debriefs at the Mug and Anchor pub in Mahone Bay. I'm sure other listeners have their favorites and highlights. On a side note, Fred Nolan and Dan Blankenship both died in their 90s. I'd assume that Tom Nolan and Dave Blankenship are in their 60s. Causes me to wonder if Tom and Dave have kids and why they're not on the show, given how much we've seen of Alex, Peter, Jack, Drake, and David over the 11 years. Maybe no interest in the search. And remember, all times are crown times. Dig on, Steve. Oh, Steve, I do sincerely miss the Mug and Anchor. I got to tell you, if I ever make it up to Oak Island, and I'm still waiting for that invitation, right? But if I ever make it up there, the Mug and Anchor might actually be my first stop. This really looks like a great pub. Steve, as we were talking about in the last email from Scott, you nailed a couple of those things right there that the show just left hanging out there for us. Among my favorites being when they ended a season with a snake camera going into a mysterious cellar, possibly at the Ball Foundation, and then nothing. Couldn't find anything in there, never came back to it. It's an editing choice Prometheus made, you know, and it's an editing choice they've been making for years. It is a rare and often very low-key event to actually have an artifact debunked on the show for us, even though we know many of them have been debunked. They just don't want us to know that. Honestly, it's a choice by the editors that is the single biggest cause of skeptics and especially of criticism of the show. If they would just clue us in on things that have been debunked, maybe many of us would believe it would add more credibility to the show amongst its viewers and more weight to the artifacts that they find that are genuinely, in the long run, mysterious and intriguing. I don't disagree with that. Thank you, as always, Steve, for all your help. Okay, folks, that's all for the emails today. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along, digginoakisland@gmail.com. All right, guys, it's time now to discuss Season 11, Episode 18 of The Curse of Oak Island, called May the Norse Be With You. I gotta tell you, man, this episode was great. It deserved a much less cringy title than that. It was a cracker of an episode. They're really hitting their stride here at the end of this season. Season 11 looks like it's going to end strong here. So I'm not sure where to start, actually. So let's start off with the swamp, and then we'll kind of quickly hit on lot 5 before we take a break. The team has resumed work on both locations following the hurricane, Hurricane Lee, which put a bit of a delay on both of these locations, the Money Pit and Lot 5 and the Swamp as well, all of them, really. But not so much on the Money Pit as the Swamp, right? But as we see, the Swamp has been re-drained. I think I may have just invented a word there. And Billy is at the helm of the digger in the southeast corner again with the usual group of Jack Begley, Gary Drayton, and Rick Lagina inspecting the dirt piles as he digs. Rick pulls out a piece of wood that both Gary and Billy think could be from a ship. Though I'm not so sure about that one, if I'm honest, not really sure what they're talking about. They said that it was looked like it was from the keel of a boat because it was sort of rounded off like the bottom of a boat would be. But there is also a giant hole in it. I don't think I would want a hole at the bottom of my keel, would you? Next, they pull out what is obviously part of a wood plank of some kind. And again, we start talking about this being from a ship. Guys, this area of the swamp was the beach centuries ago, in right before the 1900s. It was the beach. You know, this is exactly where you would expect to find something like this. Paul on the Patreon said it well. Wood floats, Swamp was Ocean Shore. Ocean has currents. And then in all caps, he writes, Templars or Vikings. Or, Paul, literally anyone else with a boat could have lost this piece of wood and had it drift onto Oak Island and end up right here. There is also some talk here about how this is the same general spot where they found what they called a piece of a ship's railing. And the narration says it just like that. But I was wondering, does anybody remember more clearly that artifact? Was it actually confirmed by an expert of any kind to be a ship's railing? My understanding is that it was just what the guys standing around the swamp thought it looked like when they pulled it dirty out of the ground. I don't recall any expert confirming that it was indeed a ship's rail, but the narration here, it talks about it like, yep, that was definitely a ship's rail they found here. Remind me if I'm wrong about that one, guys. Anyway, later on in the episode, Gary and Billy are joined by Steve Guptill in this same area when Billy digs right through what looks like possibly some kind of wooden structure. But whatever it was is now in pieces, thanks to the excavator. For those of you who thought the government was being unreasonable when they wanted them to stop digging around possible First Nations artifacts, you need only watch this scene right here to understand why the government did that. Regardless, this find is followed up by a lot of talk regarding Fred Nolan, again, claiming to have found a wall or a dam over here, which, unsurprisingly, is another Nolan find that the show just doesn't seem to have a photograph to show us what it was. Anyway, later in the episode, Dr. Spooner comes down to have a look. He points out a reddish-colored dirt that is there by this structure just underneath it, and he says it's the same color, the same kind of dirt that they found under the stone road. Now, this scene was chopped up quite a bit, so it's hard to figure out exactly what Spooner was trying to say, other than perhaps the wood and the road were built or placed here kind of along the same time, right? Needless to say, this area is going to need proper excavation and one done without a humongous digger, if that's okay, that so not, as to not destroy everything in its path. All right, so quickly, let's head over to Lot 5 before we take a break. The archaeologists are back, Helen Sheldon and Laird Niven, along with Jack Begley, who seems to be there only to provide sort of enthusiastic speculation. Helen pulls out a copper coin, which she says is most likely an English halfpenny from the 1780s. She then starts talking about how this feature they're looking at here is most likely a filled-in cellar, and that it was likely abandoned and then filled in during the 1780s. Now, it's not clear if this coin is the only thing that brings her to that conclusion. From the way she's talking here, it doesn't seem that way. Hard to tell. The team then pulls out of the dirt a handmade spike, and one that they all agree is way too big to have been used in the making of a house. So what is it? I mean, we don't find out today. Hopefully we'll get some analysis on it soon. But let's just back up a bit. That 1780s date is something of a real letdown for me. Honestly, I was really hoping we were talking about, you know, at least pre-1760, since that is the approximate date when the island was divided into lots and then sold off. So what that means is, for about two decades, whatever this thing was, and it was supposedly bigger than a home, right? Bigger than a homestead, but whatever it was either built and used by the property owner for that time frame, most likely for farming, or at best, maybe it was sitting there for decades before the property owner who bought the property decided to take it down and then fill this in. But even if that were the case, how mysterious could it possibly have been? Because there's absolutely no record of it. Nothing at all. Man, I hope we're all wrong about this one. I hope those dates are just off enough to not ruin the intriguing quality of this Lot 5 structure. Okay, let's head over to the money pit. Scott Barlow is meeting with Roger 14 from Dumas to discuss the situation at the garden shaft. Remember last week they found planks side by side, like it was a floor or a roof, possibly, of this tunnel. Well, at least that's what they were hoping, only their hopes were pretty well dashed somewhat here. As the rest of the team arrives, Scott declares, this is his quote, "This is the strangest thing I think we ever could have encountered down there. We cannot find any signs of walls or ceilings." So basically, no tunnel, but weirdly, just this level of planks. Where is the void they were finding earlier in the year in their exploratory drilling? And add to that, Matt on the Patreon wrote, quote, what happened to the non-Ferris hits from the end of the season? That just go away? So many unanswered questions here, Matt. The guys do all they can to kind of sound excited about the future here, but they have to be devastated. They were hoping to find a tunnel that would be open and that they could follow all the way to the treasure. But instead, it's just a couple of planks of wood and with no easy to discern purpose. Maybe after some dating of this wood is done, things can get a little more positive here, but man, oh man, this was not how we all hoped this would go. It will be very interesting to see how this garden shaft project proceeds here as we get to the end of the season. So later on, Carmen Legg comes to the lab on Oak Island to see two metal pieces found by Gary Drayton last week in the garden shaft. Not the non-ferrous metal ones, but the two he found last week. These are two small nail-looking pieces. The first one Carmen can't seem to recognize, so he asks Emma Culligan to work her magic and scan them both so he can have a better look. So after the scanning, Carmen says the first one is a nail or a fastener of some kind, but also that it was too small to have been used in the building of a shaft or structure. The second item is harder for him to figure out exactly what it is, but from the scans, he could tell it's old from the way it was made. He says it's from the late 1400s up to the mid-1700s. Now, this caused Steve on the Patreon to ask, quote, anyone else having trouble reconciling the fact that nothing they've dated in the tunnels and shafts seems to predate the 1400s. Does it match up with the narrative of the Vikings and the Templars? Totally true, Steve. Again, we keep jumping all over the place with dates, and despite the theories of the day, these dates don't seem to even match those. And also, despite how cool these dates actually are, and they are, the fact that there are nails down there that would not have been used to build a shaft structure is also pretty cool. But the key is, in the long term, we need to find and confirm this tunnel. If we can't do that through the garden shaft, then how do we do it? I guess we just need to stay tuned. Now, finally, we have a crackpot session, and a really good one. And as we all could have guessed, it's about the Vikings. Well, it's not really about the Vikings. We'll get to that in a second. So the team is joined in the war room by a Dr. Doug Simmons, who is a retired professor of psychology from, I think the narrator says, Acadia University in Nova Scotia. Now, Doug Kroll starts explaining Simmons' background, his relationship to Doug and Oak Island, but this scene is so strangely edited, I really didn't take much from it. So let's not worry about his background or anything like that for now. He's a professor of psychology, so he's not a history expert or anything like that. But in the long run, neither am I. It doesn't really matter, right? Simmons is here to talk about a possible connection between the Vikings with their knowledge of exploring the North Atlantic coast of North America and the Knights Templar, and how the Knights Templar could have known they could sail here with their most precious relics. This is key, right, to any Templar theory, because as the story goes, the French king and the Pope turn against the Templars, the Knights were rounded up, and in this desperate escape from continental Europe, the remaining Templars who managed to evade arrest gather up their most valuable and most sacred treasures. Undocumented treasures, mind you. There is no proof that any such treasures existed anywhere. But I digress. again, no concrete proof of such treasures. But regardless, they loaded all of these things, like the Holy Grail, the menorah, the Ark of the Covenant, and so on, onto boats and hightailed it out of there, sailing to Scotland first, and then from there onto North America to dig a 100-foot-deep shaft and treasure vault to store them in. Or to hide them, I guess. Now, at this point in history, the only way the Knights Templar could have even known about North America existing at all would have been through the knowledge of the Vikings, who were, as far as we know, the only people we can prove actually made it that far west. Of course, there are others, including the Irish, right, who some folks speculate sailed as far as the Americas, some even before the Vikings, like the Irish St. Brendan the Voyager. But the Vikings are the only pre-Columbian Europeans who we have actual archaeological proof of them making it here. So you can see why establishing this link between the Templars and the Vikings is really paramount to any such Templar theory of Oak Island being even the least bit plausible. So what Dr. Simmons talks about is someone named King Sigurd of Norway, also known as Sigurd the Crusader. He was the king of Norway from 1103, I think, to 1130, and he's best known as the first European king to launch and lead his own crusade to the Holy Land. You got that right. The first European king to launch and lead his own crusade to the Holy Land was the king of Norway. He did this in 1107, 8 years after the first crusaders captured Jerusalem and established what became known as the Crusader States. Sigurd sailed something like 5,000 men and 60 ships to Jerusalem, helping them sort of fortify the city, and also participated in some military activities there as the Crusaders looked to expand their foothold in the territory. Now, according to Simmons, it was his time in Jerusalem when Sigurd, as he says, interacted with the knights who would eventually become part of the Templar Order. And he left some folks behind as well, and maybe even some ships. And it's in this interaction, in this time frame between Sigurd and these people, that we have what we can call who would become the Templars. We have what we would call the first somewhat reasonable theory of how the Knights Templar might have come upon the knowledge of the Vikings and their voyages across the Atlantic. Now, as you probably guessed, I have a few questions, and so too did the patrons. Speaking specifically of Steve, a different Steve from the last Steve, who said during the chat, FYI, everyone, the Viking period ended in 1066. The Templars didn't appear until after the First Crusade in 1096. So yes, it was impossible for the two to have interacted. To which Matthew replied, quote, I think the term Viking is a little misleading as well, as Sigurd was a Christian king. Okay, guys, let me just plug in what might be some useful information here for this debate. Let me back up a little bit, too. I told you that Sigurd came to the Holy Land. He eventually returned to Norway. He did leave ships and troops behind, but the story that I've always read is that he didn't leave them behind in the Holy Land. He left them behind on his next stop, which was Constantinople. So there's a little ambiguity there in that. So let's put that to the side for just a little bit. Again, the only generally and archaeologically accepted evidence of the Vikings landing in North America is on the very northeastern tip of Newfoundland, in a place called La Anse aux Meadows. Now, that site dates to the early 11th century, right around the year 1000. Sigurd came along a century later, so could he have been aware of this settlement, or certainly of where this settlement was? I mean, I don't see why not. As far as I can tell, we don't have anything that proves he had such knowledge. But, you know, I'll play along here a little bit. I'm okay with that leap of faith. That kind of makes a little sense. Now, a couple of other things to bear in mind as well. As I said, Sigurd went to the Holy Land in 1107 or so. Now, the Templars were not actually founded until more than a decade later in 1119. So we see the discrepancy. However, among the founding Templars was a Flemish knight named Godfrey of Saint-Omer. Little is actually known about our boy Godfrey here, except that he was a founding member of the Knights Templar. But there is some evidence, a little flimsy, to suggest that he came to Jerusalem as part of the First Crusade in 1099. In fact, have you ever seen the Templar symbol of the two knights riding a single horse? Legend has it that those two knights were the famous Hugh de Payens and our man Godfrey here, who together were supposedly, this is all legend sort of, you know, were too poor to be able to afford more than one horse. So, could Godfrey have met King Sigurd in Jerusalem and told him about the Vikings' journey across the Atlantic? Sure he could. And I'd like to imagine that this conversation was happening over a flagon of ale during some drunken party with these two burly dudes swapping old stories. So we have established a possible, although I'll admit, certainly not at all, anywhere near proven, but possible connection between the Templars and the Vikings. Also, keep in mind, Godfrey would have had to pass this navigational knowledge, secretly, mind you, down through the Templar Order for the next 200 years, as any such Templar voyage, at least as the theories go, didn't happen until somewhere after their persecution, which was in 1307. So when they loaded those ships with the holy relics and were about to sail west into the great unknown, someone would have had to have said to the captain, hey, did you know Godfrey and the ale and the flagon of ale with some guy named Sigurd in a place there. You understand what I mean? And these guys would have been dead for centuries. Let me just also add a couple of other things. There's a lot of talk here about Nolan's Cross again. We said this all last week, but let me repeat it. According to Professor Gasparini's theory, the alignment with which the cross is based comes from the year 1250. This is the year now that the narrator likes to say the cross was made. Although there's no proof of that, we're just working with this astro alignment theory. Okay. The cross was built in 1250. Folks, that's decades before, five plus decades before the persecution of the Templars, more than half a century before they would have needed to make this harrowing escape from Europe to the New World. So needless to say, there are a lot of holes to fill in here with this theory. Also, Marty makes a comment that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that he's coming to the realization that knowledge of North America in the pre-Columbian era of Europe was more widespread than we originally thought. Marty, I think that's taking it way too far. Listen, folks, there is a reason it took half a millennium after L'Anse aux Meadows was created by the Vikings for Europeans to return to North America. And the biggest reason is that knowledge was not at all widespread. Oh, and by the way, the distances the crow flies between L'Anse aux Meadows and Oak Island is kind of about the same distance between Portland, Maine and Cape Fear at the bottom of North Carolina. And that's not taking into account the extra distance you have to sail around Newfoundland to get there. So it's much further than that. It's kind of almost like sailing from Maine to the Caribbean. It's not right around the corner. You know, so just because the Vikings landed in Newfoundland doesn't mean they had any knowledge of Nova Scotia. I mean, maybe, but we can't be sure. So what do I think of all this? Do we have a possible connection between the Templars and the Vikings? Well, I would say yes and no. I say no because we actually have what we actually have here, if you think about it, is a non-Viking era Christian Norwegian king in the same city at roughly the same time as maybe a Flemish knight who would one day become a Templar. That is what we actually have. So those two things are not the same. A connection between the Templars and the Vikings and that is not the same thing. However, I also say yes, because this is as close as I think I've ever seen where we've gotten a connection between these two entities. And it is something really cool, certainly worth exploring. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Digging Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you can really help out the show by becoming a patron. If you think this show is worth $5 a month to you, then head over to patreon.com/diggingoakisland. Sign up, become a patron, $5 a month. You cancel anytime. If you want to make a one-time donation, the only way I can do that is via Venmo. At Dave McBride Music is the username. If you want to help the podcast out in another way, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your shows. Thanks to everyone who does that and everybody who has done that already. You can also follow the show on Facebook. Just go to your search bar, put in at Digging Oak Island. And if you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, the best way to do that is via email, diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Just keep in mind, if you do send me an email or direct message on social media, I may just answer it here on the podcast. So if you don't want your message read aloud, please make a note of that. Well, folks, it is crown time. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.